shall suffer. That fish of yours will eat up all the others, and people too. Behind this foolishness it is possible to see that the one cause, the obscure being who cut himself, yields within the frame of the world dual effects, good and evil. The story is not as naive as it appears. Furthermore, the metaphysical pre-existence of the Platonic archetype of the shark is implied in the curious logic of the final dialogue. This is a conception inherent in every myth. Universal, too, is the casting of the antagonist, the representative of evil, in the role of the clown. Devils, both the lusty thick heads and the sharp, clever deceivers, are always clowns. Though they may triumph in the world of space and time, both they and their work simply disappear when the perspective shifts to the transcendental. They are the mistakers of shadow for substance. They symbolize the inevitable imperfections of the realm of shadow. And so long as we remain this side, the veil cannot be done away.
Breaking free from cosmogonic associations, the negative, clown-devil aspect of the demiurgic power has become a particular favorite in the tales told for amusement. A vivid example is Coyote of the American Plains. Reynard the Fox is a European incarnation of this figure.
The Black Tatars of Siberia say that when the demiurge Pajana fashioned the first human beings, he found that he was unable to produce a life-giving spirit for them. So he had to go up to heaven and procure souls from Kudai, the high god, leaving, meanwhile, a naked dog to guard the figures of his manufacture. The devil, Erlik, arrived while he was away. And Erlik said to the dog, "Thou hast no hair. I will give thee golden hair if thou wilt give into my hands these soulless people." The proposal pleased the dog, and he gave the people he was guarding to the tempter. Erlik defiled them with his spittle, but took flight the moment he saw God approaching to give them life. God saw what had been done, and so he turned the human bodies inside out. That is why we have spittle and impurity in our intestines. The folk mythologies take up the story of creation only at the moment where the transcendental emanations break into spatial forms. Nevertheless, they do not differ from the great mythologies on any essential point in their evaluations of human circumstance. Their symbolic personages correspond in import, frequently also in trait and deed, to those of the higher iconographies, and the wonder world in which they move is precisely that of the greater revelations, the world and the age between deep sleep and waking consciousness, the zone where the one breaks into the manifold and the many are reconciled in the one. Chapter 2. The Virgin Birth. 1. Mother Universe. The world-generating spirit of the Father passes into the manifold of earthly experience through a transforming medium, the Mother of the World. She is a personification of the primal element named in the second verse of Genesis, where we read that the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. In the Hindu myth, she is the female figure through whom the Self begot all creatures. More abstractly understood, she is the world-bounding frame, space, time, and causality, the shell of the cosmic egg. More abstractly still, she is the lure that moved the self-brooding absolute to the act of creation. In mythologies emphasizing the maternal rather than the paternal aspect of the Creator, this original female fills the world stage in the beginning, playing the roles that are elsewhere assigned to males. And she is virgin because her spouse is the invisible unknown. A strange representation of this figure is to be found in the mythology of the Finns. In Runo 1 of the Kalevala, it is told how the virgin daughter of the air descended from the sky mansions into the primeval sea, and there, for centuries, floated on the everlasting waters.
Then a storm arose in fury, from the east a mighty tempest, and the sea was wildly foaming, and the waves dashed ever higher. Thus the tempest rocked the virgin, and the billows drove the maiden o'er the ocean's azure surface, on the crest of foaming billows, till the wind that blew around her and the sea woke life within her.
For 7 centuries the water mother floated with the child in her womb, unable to give it birth. She prayed to Ukko, the highest god, and he sent a teal to build its nest on her knee. The teal's eggs fell from the knee and broke. The fragments formed the earth, sky, sun, moon, and clouds. Then the water mother, floating still, herself began the work of the world shaper.
When the 9th year had passed over, and the summer 10th was passing, from the sea her head she lifted, and her forehead she uplifted, and she then began creation, and she brought the world to order, on the open ocean surface, on the far extending waters. Wheresoe'er her hand she pointed, there she formed the jutting headlands. Wheresoe'er her feet she rested, there she formed the caves for fishes. When she dived beneath the water, there she formed the depths of ocean. When towards the land she turned her, there the level shores extended. Where her feet to land extended, spots were formed for salmon netting. Where her head the land touched lightly, there the curving bays extended. Further from the land she floated, and abode in open water, and created rocks in ocean, and the reefs that eyes behold not, where the ships are often shattered, and the sailors' lives are ended.
But the babe remained in her body, growing towards a sentimental middle age.
Still unborn was Wainamoinen, still unborn the hard immortal. Wainamoinen, old and steadfast, rested in his mother's body for the space of 30 summers and the sum of 30 winters, ever on the placid waters and upon the foaming billows. So he pondered and reflected how he could continue living in a resting place so gloomy, in a dwelling far too narrow, where he could not see the moonlight, neither could behold the sunlight. Then he spake the words which follow, and expressed his thoughts in this wise: Aid me, moon, and sun release me, and the great bear lend his counsel, through the portal that I know not, through the unaccustomed passage, from the little nest that holds me, from a dwelling place so narrow, to the land conduct the roamer, to the open air conduct me, to behold the moon in heaven and the splendor of the sunlight. See the great bear stars above me, and the shining stars in heaven. When the moon no freedom gave him, neither did the sun release him, then he wearied of existence, and his life became a burden. Thereupon he moved the portal with his finger, 4th in number, opened quick the bony gateway, with the toes upon his left foot, with his knees beyond the gateway. Headlong in the water falling, with his hands the waves repelling, thus the man remained in ocean, and the hero on the billows.
Before Wainamoinen, hero already in his birth, could make his way ashore, the ordeal of a second mother womb remained to him, that of the elemental cosmic ocean. Unprotected now, he had to undergo the initiation of nature's fundamentally inhuman forces. On the level of water and wind, he had to experience again what he already so well knew.
In the sea 5 years he sojourned, waited 5 years, waited 6 years, 7 years also, even 8 years, on the surface of the ocean, by a nameless promontory, near a barren, treeless country. On the land his knees he planted, and upon his arms he rested, rose that he might view the moonbeams, and enjoy the pleasant sunlight. see the great bear's stars above him, and the shining stars in heaven. Thus was ancient Wainamoinen, he, the ever-famous minstrel, born of the divine creatrix, born of Ilmatar, his mother.
2. Matrix of Destiny. The universal goddess makes her appearance to men under a multitude of guises, for the effects of creation are multitudinous, complex, and of mutually contradictory kind when experienced from the viewpoint of the created world. The mother of life is, at the same time, the mother of death. She is masked in the ugly demonesses of famine and disease. The Sumero-Babylonian astral mythology identified the aspects of the cosmic female with the phases of the planet Venus. As morning star, she was the virgin. As evening star, the harlot. As lady of the night sky, the consort of the moon. And when extinguished under the blaze of the sun, she was the hag of hell. Wherever the Mesopotamian influence extended, the traits of the goddess were touched by the light of this fluctuating star. A myth from Southeast Africa, collected from the Wahungwe Makoni tribe of South Rhodesia, displays the aspects of the Venus Mother in coordination with the first stages of the cosmogonic cycle. Here, the original man is the moon, the morning star, his first wife, the evening star, his second. Just as Wainamoinen emerged from the womb by his own act, so this moon man emerges from the abyssal waters. He and his wives are to be the parents of the creatures of the earth. The story comes to us as follows.
Maori, God, made the first man and called him Mwetsi, moon. He put him on the bottom of a dzivoa, lake, and gave him a ngona horn, filled with ngona oil. Mwetsi lived in Dzivoa.
This horn and oil play a conspicuous role in the folklore of South Rhodesia, the modern-day nation of Zimbabwe. The ngona horn is a wonder-working instrument with the power to create fire and lightning, to impregnate the living, and to resurrect the dead.
Mwetsi said to Maori, I want to go on the earth. Maori said, you will rue it. Mwetsi said, nonetheless, I want to go on the earth. Maori said, then go on the earth. Mwetsi went out of Dzivoa and on to the earth. The earth was cold and empty. There were no grasses, no bushes, no trees. There were no animals. Mwetsi wept and said to Maori, how shall I live here? Maori said, I warned you. You have started on the path at the end of which you shall die. I will, however, give you one of your kind. Maori gave Mwetsi a maiden, who was called Masasi, the morning star. Maori said, Masasi shall be your wife for 2 years. Maori gave Masasi a fire maker. In the evening, Mwetsi went into a cave with Masasi. Masasi said, help me. We will make a fire. I will gather chimandra, kindling, and you can twirl the rusika, revolving part of the fire maker. Masasi gathered kindling. Mwetsi twirled the rusika. When the fire was lighted, Mwetsi lay down on one side of it, Masasi on the other. The fire burned between them. Mwetsi thought to himself, why has Maori given me this maiden? What shall I do with this maiden, Masasi? When it was night, Mwetsi took his ngono horn. He moistened his index finger with a drop of ngono oil. Mwetsi said, Ndini jambuka mirine mirir. I am going to jump over the fire. This sentence is many times repeated in a melodramatic ceremonial tone. Mwetsi jumped over the fire. Mwetsi approached the maiden, Masasi. Mwetsi touched Masasi's body with the ointment on his finger. Then Mwetsi went back to his bed and slept. When Mwetsi wakened in the morning, he looked over to Masasi. Mwetsi saw that Masasi's body was swollen. When day broke, Masasi began to bear. Masasi bore grasses. Masasi bore bushes. Masasi bore trees. Masasi did not stop bearing till the earth was covered with grasses, bushes, and trees. The trees grew. They grew till their tops reached the sky. When the tops of the trees reached the sky, it began to rain. Muetsi and Masasi lived in plenty. They had fruits and grain. Muetsi built a house. Muetsi made an iron shovel. Muetsi made a hoe and planted crops. Masasi platted fish traps and caught fish. Masasi fetched wood and water. Masasi cooked. Thus Muetsi and Masasi lived for 2 years. After 2 years, Maori said to Masasi, "The time is up." Maori took Masasi from the earth and put her back in Zivoa. Muetsi wailed. He wailed and wept and said to Maori, "What shall I do without Masasi? Who will fetch wood and water for me? Who will cook for me?" 8 days long, Muetsi wept. 8 days long, Muetsi wept. Then Maori said, "I have warned you that you are going to your death, but I will give you another woman. I will give you Morongo, the evening star. Morongo will stay with you for 2 years. Then I shall take her back again." Maori gave Muetsi Morongo. Morongo came to Muetsi in the hut. In the evening, Muetsi wanted to lie down on his side of the fire. Morongo said, "Do not lie down over there. Lie with me." Muetsi lay down beside Morongo. Muetsi took the Ngono horn, put some ointment on his index finger. But Morongo said, "Don't be like that. I am not like Masasi. Now smear your loins with Ngono oil. Smear my loins with Ngono oil." Muetsi did as he was told. Morongo said, "Now couple with me." Muetsi coupled with Morongo. Muetsi went to sleep. Towards morning, Muetsi woke. As he looked over to Morongo, he saw that her body was swollen. As day broke, Morongo began to give birth. The first day, Morongo gave birth to chickens, sheep, goats. The second night, Muetsi slept with Morongo again. The next morning, she bore eland and cattle. The third night, Muetsi slept with Morongo again. The next morning, Morongo bore first boys and then girls. The boys who were born in the morning were grown up by nightfall. On the fourth night, Muetsi wanted to sleep with Morongo again. But there came a thunderstorm, and Maori spoke, "Let be. You are going quickly to your death." Muetsi was afraid. The thunderstorm passed over. When it had gone, Morongo said to Muetsi, "Make a door and then use it to close the entrance to the hut. Then Maori will not be able to see what we are doing. Then you can sleep with me." Muetsi made a door. With it he closed the entrance to the hut. Then he slept with Morongo. Muetsi slept. Towards morning, Muetsi woke. Muetsi saw that Morongo's body was swollen. As day broke, Morongo began to give birth. Morongo bore lions, leopards, snakes, and scorpions. Maori saw it. Maori said to Muetsi, "I warned you." On the fifth night, Muetsi wanted to sleep with Morongo again. But Morongo said, "Look, your daughters are grown. Couple with your daughters." Muetsi looked at his daughters. He saw that they were beautiful and that they were grown up. So he slept with them. They bore children. The children which were born in the morning were full grown by night. And so Muetsi became the Mambo, king of a great people. But Morongo slept with the snake. Morongo no longer gave birth. She lived with the snake. One day Muetsi returned to Morongo and wanted to sleep with her. Morongo said, "Let be." Muetsi said, "But I want to." He lay with Morongo. Under Morongo's bed lay the snake. The snake bit Muetsi. Muetsi sickened. After the snake had bitten Muetsi, Muetsi sickened. The next day it did not rain. The plants withered. The rivers and lakes dried. The animals died. The people began to die. Many people died. Muetsi's children asked, What can we do? Muetzi's children said, We will consult the Hakata, sacred dice. The children consulted the Hakata. The Hakata said, Muetzi the Mambo is sick and pining. Send Muetzi back to the Dzivoa. Thereupon Muetzi's children strangled Muetzi and buried him. They buried Marongo with Muetzi. Then they chose another man to be Mambo. Marongo, too, had lived for 2 years in Muetzi's Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe means roughly the royal court. The enormous prehistoric ruins near Fort Victoria are called the Great Zimbabwe. Other stone ruins throughout southern Rhodesia are called Little Zimbabwe. It is clear that each of the three stages of procreation represents an epoch in the development of the world. The pattern for the procession was foreknown, almost as something already observed. This is indicated by the warning of the All Highest. But the Moon Man, the Mighty Living One, would not be denied the realization of his destiny. The conversation at the bottom of the lake is the dialogue of eternity and time, the colloquy of the quick, to be or not to be. Unquenchable desire is finally given its rope. Movement begins. The wives and daughters of the Moon Man are the personifications and precipitators of his destiny. With the evolution of his world-creative will, the virtues and features of the Goddess Mother were metamorphosed. After the birth from the elemental womb, the first two wives were pre-human, supra-human. But as the cosmogonic round proceeded, and the growing moment passed from its primordial to its human historical forms, the mistresses of the cosmic births withdrew, and the field remained to the women of men. Thereupon the old demiurgic sire, in the midst of his community, became a metaphysical anachronism. When at last he grew tired of the merely human and yearned back again to the wife of his abundance, the world sickened a moment under the pull of his reaction, but then released itself and ran free. The initiative passed to the community of the children. The symbolic, dream-heavy parental figures subsided into the original abyss. Only man remained on the furnished earth. The cycle had moved on. 3. Womb of Redemption. The world of human life is now the problem. Guided by the practical judgment of the kings and the instruction of the priests of the dice of divine revelation, the field of consciousness so contracts that the grand lines of the human comedy are lost in a welter of cross purposes. Men's perspectives become flat, comprehending only the light-reflecting, tangible surfaces of existence. The vista into depth closes over. The significant form of the human agony is lost to view. Society lapses into mistake and disaster. The little ego has usurped the judgment seat of the self. This is, in myth, a perpetual theme, in the voices of the prophets, a familiar cry. The people yearn for some personality who, in a world of twisted bodies and souls, will represent again the lines of the incarnate image. We are familiar with the myth from our own tradition. It occurs everywhere, under a variety of guises. When the Herod figure, the extreme symbol of the misgoverning, tenacious ego, has brought mankind to the nadir of spiritual abasement, the occult forces of the cycle begin of themselves to move. In an inconspicuous village, the maid is born who will maintain herself undefiled of the fashionable errors of her generation, a miniature in the midst of men of the cosmic woman who was the bride of the wind. Her womb, remaining fallow as the primordial abyss, summons to itself, by its very readiness, the original power that fertilized the void. Now on a certain day, while Mary stood near the fountain to fill her pitcher, the angel of the Lord appeared unto her, saying, Blessed art thou, Mary, for in thy womb thou hast prepared a habitation for the Lord. Behold, light from heaven shall come and dwell in thee, and through thee shall shine in all the world. The story is recounted everywhere, and with such striking uniformity of the main contours that the early Christian missionaries were forced to think that the devil himself must be throwing up mockeries of their teaching wherever they set their hand. Fray Pedro Simón reports in his Noticias Historiales de las Conquistas de Tierra Firme en las Indias Occidentales, Cuenca, 1627, that after work had been begun amongst the peoples of Tunja and Sogamoso in Colombia, South America,
the demon of that place began giving contrary doctrines, and, among other things, he sought to discredit what the priest had been teaching concerning the Incarnation, declaring that it had not yet come to pass, but that presently the Son would bring it to pass by taking flesh in the womb of a virgin of the village of Huachata, causing her to conceive by the rays of the sun while she yet remained a virgin. These tidings were proclaimed throughout the region, and it so happened that the headman of the village named had two virgin daughters, each desirous that the miracle should become accomplished in her. These then began going out from their father's dwellings and garden enclosure every morning at the first peep of dawn, and mounting one of the numerous hills about the village, in the direction of the sunrise, they disposed themselves in such a way that the first rays of the sun would be free to shine upon them. This going on for a number of days, it was granted the demon, by divine permission, whose judgments are incomprehensible, that things should come to pass as he had planned, and in such fashion that one of the daughters became pregnant, as she declared, by the son. 9 months, and she brought into the world a large and valuable jacuata, which, in their language, is an emerald. The woman took this, and, wrapping it in cotton, placed it between her breasts, where she kept it a number of days, at the end of which time it was transformed into a living creature, all by order of the demon. The child was named Goronchacho, and he was reared in the household of the head man, his grandfather, until he was some 24 years of age.
Then he proceeded in triumphant procession to the capital of the nation, and was celebrated throughout the provinces as the child of the sun. Hindu mythology tells of the maiden Parvati, daughter of the mountain king Himalaya, who retreated into the high hills to practice very severe austerities. A tyrant titan named Taraka had usurped the mastery of the world, and, according to the prophecy, only a son of the high god Shiva could overthrow him. Shiva, however, was the pattern god of yoga, aloof, alone, indrawn in meditation. It was impossible that Shiva should ever be moved to beget a son. Parvati determined to change the world situation by matching Shiva in meditation. Aloof, alone, indrawn into her soul, she too fasted naked beneath the blazing sun, even adding to the heat by building 4 additional great fires to each of the 4 quarters. The handsome body shriveled to a brittle construction of bones, the skin became leathery and hard, her hair stood matted and wild, the soft, liquid eyes burned. One day a Brahmin youth arrived and asked why anyone so beautiful should be destroying herself with such torture. "My desire," she replied, "is Shiva, the highest object. Shiva is a god of solitude and unshakable concentration. I therefore am practicing these austerities to move him from his state of balance and bring him to me in love." "Shiva," the youth said, "is a god of destruction. Shiva is the world annihilator. Shiva's delight is to meditate in burial grounds amidst the reek of corpses. There he beholds the rot of death, and that is congenial to his devastating heart. Shiva's garlands are of living serpents. Shiva is a pauper, furthermore, and no one knows anything of his birth. The virgin said, "He is beyond the mind of such as you, a pauper, but the fountainhead of wealth, terrifying, but the source of grace. Snake garlands or jewel garlands he can assume or put off at will. How should he have been born when he is the creator of the uncreated? Shiva is my love." The youth thereupon put away his disguise and was Shiva. 4. Folk Stories of Virgin Motherhood. The Buddha descended from heaven to his mother's womb in the shape of a milk-white elephant, the Aztec Coatlicue, she of the serpent-woven skirt, was approached by a god in the form of a ball of feathers. The chapters of Ovid's Metamorphoses swarm with nymphs beset by gods in sundry masquerades. Jove is a bull, a swan, a shower of gold. Any leaf accidentally swallowed, or any nut, or even the breath of a breeze may be enough to fertilize the ready womb. The procreating power is everywhere, and according to the whim or destiny of the hour, either a hero-savior or a world-annihilating demon may be conceived. One can never know. Images of virgin birth abound in the popular tales as well as in myth. One example will suffice, a queer folk tale from Tonga belonging to a little cycle of stories told of the handsome man, Sinalao. This tale is of particular interest not because of its extreme absurdity, but because it clearly announces in unconscious burlesque every one of the major motifs of the typical life of the hero: virgin birth, quest for the father, ordeal, atonement with the father, the assumption and coronation of the Virgin Mother, and finally, the heavenly triumph of the true sons, while the pretenders are heated hot.
There was once a certain man and his wife, and the woman was pregnant. When her time came to be delivered of her child, she called her husband to come and lift her that she might give birth. But she bore a clam, and her husband threw her down in anger. She, however, bade him take the clam and leave it in Sinilao's bathing pool. Now Sinilao came to bathe and flung the coconut husk that he had used to wash himself with on the water. The clam slid along and sucked the coconut husk and became pregnant. One day the woman, the mother of the clam, saw the clam rolling along toward her. She angrily asked the clam why she had come, but the shellfish replied that it was no time for anger and asked her to curtain off a place in which she could give birth. So a screen was placed, and the clam gave birth to a fine big baby boy. Then she rolled off back to her pool, and the woman cared for the child, who was named Fatai Going Underneath Sandalwood. Time went on, and lo, the clam was again with child, and once more came rolling along to the house that she might give birth there to her child. The performance was repeated, and again the clam bore a fine boy, who was named Myrtle Twined at Random in the Fatai. He, too, was left with the woman and her husband to be cared for. When the two children had grown up to manhood, the woman heard that Sinilao was going to hold a festival, and she determined that her two grandsons should be present. So she called the youths and bade them prepare, adding that the man to whose festival they were going was their father. When they came to where the festival was being held, they were gazed at by all the people. There was not a woman but had her eyes fixed on them. As they went along, a group of women called to them to turn aside to them, but the two youths refused and went on until they came to where the kava was being drunk. There they served the kava. But Sinilao, angry at their disturbing his festival, ordered two bowls to be brought. Then he bade his men seize one of the youths and cut him up. So the bamboo knife was sharpened to cut him. But when its point was placed on his body, it just slipped over his skin, and he cried out, "The knife is placed and slips. Do thou but sit and gaze at us, whether we are like thee or not." Then Sinilao asked what the youth had said, and they repeated the lines to him. So he ordered the two young men to be brought, and asked them who their father was. They replied that he himself was their father. After Sinilao had kissed his newfound sons, he told them to go and bring their mother. So they went to the pool and got the clam, and took her to their grandmother, who broke it open. And there stood a lovely woman named Hina at home in the river. Then they set out on their return to Sinilao. Each of the youths wore a fringed mat of the sort called taufahua, but their mother had on one of the very fine mats called tuaua. The two sons went ahead, and Hina followed. When they came to Sinilao, they found him sitting with his wives. The youths sat one at each thigh of Sinilao, and Hina sat at his side. Then Sinilao bade the people go and prepare an oven and heat it hot. And they took the wives and their children and killed and baked them. But Sinilao was wedded to Hina at home in the river.
Chapter 3. Transformations of the Hero. 1. The Primordial Hero and the Human. We have come two stages. First, from the immediate emanations of the uncreated creating to the fluid yet timeless personages of the mythological age. Second, from these created creating ones to the sphere of human history. The emanations have condensed, the field of consciousness constricted. Where formerly causal bodies were visible, now only their secondary effects come to focus in the little hard-fact pupil of the human eye. The cosmogonic cycle is now to be carried forward, therefore, not by the gods, who have become invisible, but by the heroes, more or less human in character, through whom the world's destiny is realized. This is the line where creation myths begin to give place to legend, as in the book of Genesis, following the expulsion from the garden. Metaphysics yields to prehistory, which is dim and vague at first, but becomes gradually precise in detail. The heroes become less and less fabulous, until at last, in the final stages of the various local traditions, legend opens into the common daylight of recorded time. Mwetsi, the moon man, was cut loose like a fouled anchor. The community of the children floated free into the day world of waking consciousness. But we are told that there existed among them direct sons of the now submarine father, who, like the children of his first begetting, had grown from infancy to manhood in a single day. These special carriers of cosmic power constituted a spiritual and social aristocracy. Filled with a double charge of the creative energy, they were themselves sources of revelation. Such figures appear on the dawn stage of every legendary past. They are the culture heroes, the city founders. The Chinese chronicles record that when the earth had solidified and the people were settling in the riverlands, Fu Shi, the heavenly emperor, 2953-2838 BC, governed among them. He taught his tribes how to fish with nets, to hunt, and to rear domestic animals, divided the people into clans, and instituted matrimony. from a supernatural tablet entrusted to him by a horse-shaped scaly monster out of the waters of the river Mung, he deduced the 8 diagrams, which remain to this day the fundamental symbols of traditional Chinese thought. He had been born of a miraculous conception, after a gestation of 12 years, his body being that of a serpent with human arms and the head of an ox. Shen Nung, his successor, the earthly emperor, 2838 to 2698 BC, was 8 feet 7 inches tall, with a human body but the head of a bull. He had been miraculously conceived through the influence of a dragon. The embarrassed mother had exposed her infant on a mountainside, but the wild beasts protected and nourished it. And when she learned of this, she fetched him home. Shen Nung discovered in one day 70 poisonous plants and their antidotes. Through a glass covering to his stomach, he could observe the digestion of each herb. Then he composed a pharmacopoeia that is still in use. He was the inventor of the plow and a system of barter. He is worshipped by the Chinese peasant as the prince of cereals. At the age of 168, he was joined to the immortals. Such serpent kings and minotaurs tell of a past when the emperor was the carrier of a special world-creating, world-sustaining power, very much greater than that represented in the normal human physique. In those times was accomplished the heavy titan work, the massive establishment of the foundations of our human civilization. But with the progress of the cycle, a period came when the work to be done was no longer proto or superhuman. It was the labor specifically of man. Control of the passions, exploration of the arts, elaboration of the economic and cultural institutions of the state. Now is required no incarnation of the moon bull, no serpent wisdom of the 8 diagrams of destiny, but a perfect human spirit, alert to the needs and hopes of the heart. Accordingly, the cosmogonic cycle yields an emperor in human form, who shall stand for all generations to come as the model of man, the king. Huang Ti, the Yellow Emperor, 2697 to 2597 BC, was the third of the August Three. His mother, a concubine of the prince of the province of Chao Tien, conceived him when she one night beheld the golden dazzling light around the constellation of the Great Bear. The child could talk when he was 70 days old, and at the age of 11 years succeeded to the throne. His distinguishing endowment was his power to dream. In sleep, he could visit the remotest regions and consort with immortals in the supernatural realm. Shortly following his elevation to the throne, Huang Ti fell into a dream that lasted 3 entire months, during which time he learned the lesson of the control of the heart. After a second dream of comparable length, he returned with the power to teach the people. He instructed them in the control of the forces of nature in their own hearts. This wonderful man governed China for 100 years, and during his reign the people enjoyed a veritable golden age. He gathered 6 great ministers around him, with whose help he composed a calendar, inaugurated mathematical calculations, and taught the making of utensils of wood, pottery, and metal, the building of boats and carriages, the use of money, and the construction of musical instruments of bamboo. He appointed public places for the worship of God. He instituted the bounds and laws of private property. His queen discovered the art of weaving silk. He planted 100 varieties of grain, vegetables, and trees, favored the development of birds, quadrupeds, reptiles, and insects, taught the uses of water, fire, wood, and earth, and regulated the movements of the tides. Before his death, at the age of 111, the phoenix and the unicorn appeared in the gardens of the empire, in attestation to the perfection of his reign. 2. Childhood of the human hero. The earlier culture hero of the snake body and bull head carried within him from birth the spontaneous creative power of the natural world. That was the meaning of his form. The man hero, on the other hand, must descend to re-establish connection with the infrahuman. This is the sense, as we have seen, of the adventure of the hero. But the makers of legend have seldom rested content to regard the world's great heroes as mere human beings who broke past the horizons that limited their fellows and returned with such boons as any man with equal faith and courage might have found. On the contrary, the tendency has always been to endow the hero with extraordinary powers from the moment of birth, or even the moment of conception. The whole hero life is shown to have been a pageant of marvels, with the great central adventure as its culmination. This accords with the view that herohood is predestined rather than simply achieved, and opens the problem of the relationship of biography to character. Jesus, for example, can be regarded as a man who by dint of austerities and meditation attained wisdom. Or, on the other hand, one may believe that a god descended and took upon himself the enactment of a human career. The first view would lead one to imitate the master literally, in order to break through, in the same way as he, to the transcendent redemptive experience. But the second states that the hero is rather a symbol to be contemplated than an example to be literally followed. The divine being is a revelation of the omnipotent self, which dwells within us all. The contemplation of the life thus should be undertaken as a meditation on one's own immanent divinity, not as a prelude to precise imitation. The lesson being not, do thus and be good, but know this and be God.
This formula is, of course, not precisely that of the common Christian teaching, where, though Jesus is reported to have declared that the kingdom of God is within, the Church has maintained that, since man is created only in the image of God, the distinction between the soul and its creator is absolute, thus retaining, as the final reach of their wisdom, the dualistic distinction between man's eternal soul and the divinity. The transcending of this pair of opposites is not encouraged, indeed is rejected as pantheism, and has sometimes been rewarded with the stake. Nevertheless, the prayers and diaries of the Christian mystics abound in ecstatic descriptions of the unitive, soul-shattering experience, while Dante's vision at the conclusion of the Divine Comedy certainly goes beyond the orthodox, dualistic, concretistic dogma of the finality of the personalities of the Trinity. Where this dogma is not transcended, the myth of going to the Father is taken literally, as describing man's final goal. As for the problem of imitating Jesus as a human model, or meditating upon him as a god, the history of the Christian attitude may be roughly summarized as follows. 1. A period of literally following the Master, Jesus, by renouncing the world as he did, primitive Christianity. 2. A period of meditating on Christ crucified as the divinity within the heart, meanwhile leading one's life in the world as the servant of this God, early and medieval Christianity. 3. A rejection of most of the instruments supporting meditation, meanwhile, however, continuing to lead one's life in the world as the servant or vehicle of the God whom one has ceased to visualize, Protestant Christianity. 4. An attempt to interpret Jesus as a model human being, but without accepting his ascetic path, liberal Christianity.
In Part 1, The Adventure of the Hero, we regarded the redemptive deed from the first standpoint, which may be called the psychological. We now must describe it from the second, where it becomes a symbol of the same metaphysical mystery that it was the deed of the hero himself to rediscover and bring to view. In the present chapter, therefore, we shall consider first the miraculous childhood, by which it is shown that a special manifestation of the immanent divine principle has become incarnate in the world, and then, in succession, the various life roles through which the hero may enact his work of destiny. These vary in magnitude according to the needs of the time. Stated in the terms already formulated, the hero's first task is to experience consciously the antecedent stages of the cosmogonic cycle, to break back through the epochs of emanation. His second, then, is to return from that abyss to the plane of contemporary life, there to serve as a human transformer of demiurgic potentials. Huang Ti had the power to dream. This was his road of descent and return. Vainamoinen's second or water birth threw him back to an experience of the elemental. In the Tonga tale of the clam wife, the retreat began with the birth of the mother. The brother heroes sprang from an infrahuman womb. The deeds of the hero in the second part of his personal cycle will be proportionate to the depth of his descent during the first. The sons of the clam wife came up from the animal level. Their physical beauty was superlative. Vainamoinen was reborn from the elemental waters and winds. His endowment was to rouse or quell with bardic song the elements of nature and of the human body. Huang Ti sojourned in the kingdom of the spirit. He taught the harmony of the heart. The Buddha broke past even the zone of the creative gods and came back from the void. He announced salvation from the cosmogonic round. If the deeds of an actual historical figure proclaim him to have been a hero, the builders of his legend will invent for him appropriate adventures in depth. These will be pictured as journeys into miraculous realms, and are to be interpreted as symbolic, on the one hand, of descents into the night sea of the psyche, and on the other, of the realms or aspects of man's destiny that are made manifest in the respective lives. King Sargon of Akkadia, circa 2550 BC, was born of a lowly mother. His father was unknown. Set adrift in a basket of bulrushes on the waters of the Euphrates, he was discovered by Aki, the husbandman, whom he was brought up to serve as gardener. The goddess Ishtar favored the youth. Thus he became, at last, king and emperor, renowned as the living god. Chandragupta, 4th century BC, the founder of the Hindu Maurya dynasty, was abandoned in an earthen jar at the threshold of a cow's shed. A herdsman discovered and fostered the infant. One day, when he was playing with his companions a game of High King in the judgment seat, little Chandragupta commanded that the worst of the offenders should have their hands and feet cut off. Then, at his word, the amputated members immediately returned to place. A passing prince, beholding the miraculous game, bought the child for 1,000 harshapanas and at home discovered by physical signs that he was a Maurya. Pope Gregory the Great, AD 540-604, was born of noble twins who at the instigation of the devil had committed incest. His penitent mother set him to sea in a little casket. He was found and fostered by fishermen, and at the age of 6 was sent to a cloister to be educated as a priest. But he desired the life of a knightly warrior. Entering a boat, he was born miraculously to the country of his parents, where he won the hand of the queen, who presently proved to be his mother. After discovery of this second incest, Gregory remained 17 years in penance, chained to a rock in the middle of the sea. The keys to the chains were tossed to the waters, but when at the end of the long period they were discovered in the belly of a fish, this was taken to be a providential sign. The penitent was conducted to Rome, where in due course he was elected pope. Charlemagne, 742-814, was persecuted as a child by his elder brothers and took flight to Saracen Spain. There, under the name of Mainet, he rendered signal services to the king. He converted the king's daughter to the Christian faith, and the two secretly arranged to marry. After further deeds, the royal youth returned to France, where he overthrew his former persecutors and triumphantly assumed the crown. Then he ruled 100 years, surrounded by a zodiac of 12 peers. According to all reports, his beard and hair were very long and white. Actually, Charles the Great was beardless and bald. One day, sitting under his judgment tree, he rendered justice to a snake, and in gratitude, the reptile bestowed on him a charm that involved him in a love affair with a woman already dead. This amulet fell into a well at Aix. That is why Aix became the emperor's favorite residence. After his long wars against the Saracens, Saxons, Slavs, and Northmen, the ageless emperor died. But he sleeps only, to awake in the hour of his country's need. During the later Middle Ages, he once arose from the dead to participate in a crusade. Each of these biographies exhibits the variously rationalized theme of the infant exile and return. This is a prominent feature in all legend, folktale, and myth. Usually an effort is made to give it some semblance of physical plausibility. However, when the hero in question is a great patriarch, wizard, prophet, or incarnation, the wonders are permitted to develop beyond all bounds. The popular Hebrew legend of the birth of Father Abraham supplies an example of the frankly supernatural infant exile. The event of the birth had been read by Nimrod in the stars.
For this impious king was a cunning astrologer, and it was manifest to him that a man would be born in his day who would rise up against him and triumphantly give the lie to his religion. In his terror at the fate foretold him in the stars, he sent for his princes and governors and asked them to advise him in the matter. They answered and said, "Our unanimous advice is that thou shouldst build a great house, station a guard at the entrance thereof, and make known in the whole of thy realm that all pregnant women shall repair thither together with their midwives, who are to remain with them when they are delivered. When the days of a woman to be delivered are fulfilled, and the child is born, it shall be the duty of the midwife to kill it, if it be a boy. But if the child be a girl, it shall be kept alive, and the mother shall receive gifts and costly garments, and a herald shall proclaim, 'Thus is done unto the woman who bears a daughter.'" The king was pleased with this counsel, and he had a proclamation published throughout his whole kingdom, summoning all the architects to build a great house for him, 60 ells high and 80 wide. After it was completed, he issued a second proclamation, summoning all pregnant women thither, and there they were to remain until their confinement. Officers were appointed to take the women to the house, and guards were stationed in it and about it, to prevent the women from escaping thence. He furthermore sent midwives to the house, and commanded them to slay the men children at their mother's breasts. But if a woman bore a girl, she was to be arrayed in byssus, silk, and embroidered garments, and led forth from the house of detention amid great honours. No less than 70,000 children were slaughtered thus. Then the angels appeared before God and spoke, "Seest thou not what he doth, yon sinner and blasphemer, Nimrod son of Canaan, who slays so many innocent babes that have done no harm?" God answered and said, "Ye holy angels, I know it and I see it, for I neither slumber nor sleep. I behold, and I know the secret things and the things that are revealed. And ye shall witness what I will do unto this sinner and blasphemer, for I will turn my hand against him to chastise him." It was about this time that Terah espoused the mother of Abraham, and she was with child. When her time approached, she left the city in great terror, and wandered toward the desert, walking along the edge of a valley, until she happened across a cave. She entered this refuge, and on the next day she was seized with the throes, and she gave birth to a son. The whole cave was filled with the light of the child's countenance, as with the splendor of the sun, and the mother rejoiced exceedingly. The babe she bore was our father, Abraham. His mother lamented, and said to her son,